Michael Nicholson, Reel 25.
So Rhodesia was an hour and a half's flight away from Johannesburg. So I could almost commute there. Quite often I would be, you know, having breakfast in my house in Johannesburg. The phone would ring either from London or from Salisbury, the capital of Rhodesia then, and something had happened. London wanted it covered, and I could be up there for lunchtime, or pretty soon after. And the only problem was, of course, that you could never get stories back the same day out of Rhodesia. There were two flights a day from Salisbury to Johannesburg, one in the morning, and one about 2:15, and one, I think, later in the evening. Which meant if you were covering a story, it had to be covered before midday in Rhodesia in order to get to the airport, do your commentary, record your commentary, clear customs, and freight it to Johannesburg, where it would be met by one of our producers, edited, processed. Remember, we were filming right up to 80, 81. It's all film. It would be satellited from SABC. If it was a really major story, then we would charter a Learjet from Johannesburg. It would come up whenever we beckoned it. Sometimes the very last hour, 6 o'clock at night, and it would be flown back down to Johannesburg and satellited from SABC. But it had to be a massive story because, you know, the Learjet was £2,000. The satellite was about the same, you know, so 4 grand was a lot of money to pay for a story, but, you know, we did it, not frequently, but we did it, until 1979, when, and I'll explain later, we pioneered quite a unique satellite link of our own. So I went to Rhodesia, I first went to Rhodesia in 73. Again, you went in not quite as covertly as you did into South Africa, but you had to play it fairly cool. Again, the Rhodesians did not censor you; they did not insist on seeing your script. Or again, like the South Africans, it was retrospective censorship. If they didn't like what you were doing, then you were out. And Ian Smith's Ministry of Information dumped quite a few people. Peter Niswan was one of the most famous, perhaps. The first stories were, I think one of the very first stories I did there was The Protected Village. By this time, 73, 74, Mugabe's guerrillas, his ZANU-PF guerrillas, were coming across the border from Mozambique, down the Pongwe Valley, and Nkoma's people were coming across the Zambezi Valley, all in that northern and northeastern border, and the farms were being attacked. Another story we did was how the farmers and their families protected themselves, you know, put huge wire fences up. They had landmines around their property. They carried guns at all time. They had what they call the Agri-Alert. It was a radio system in which everyone was connected, so if one farm was attacked, they could call in help from the others, and from the army and police. Very brave people. We were never allowed to go out with the army. As I said, the press was not popular in Rhodesia because the international press were always giving Rhodesia and Rhodesians a hard time. Therefore, they didn't care. I mean, they really didn't care a toss about opinion. And they knew it would always be a bad comment from us. So the army, especially, wanted to have nothing to do with us. Usually, armies are very keen to show how good they are, how much what they're winning, and what. Quite often it's the vanity of the generals who want to be seen, but none of that applied, and so we never saw action. The only guy who did out of all the television people there was a man called Richard Cecil. I say man, he was about 25. And he was the great-grandson of the original Lord Cecil, Lord Salisbury, who owned so much of Rhodesia, and after the city was named. And Richard, because of his aristocratic connections, was able to inveigle his way into the inner circle. And he went out on quite a few occasions with the army. He went in the camouflage uniforms. He actually did parachute drops. And luckily, he would sell his material to us, so ITN did get some action footage. He was very gung-ho, very young, very keen, but finally was shot in an ambush. The nearest that I ever came to being under fire was a very comical way. It could have been a tragic way, but it was rather comical. The army captured at one of Mugabe's guerrillas. I've forgotten his name now. I think it was an invented name anyway, because they couldn't give away his proper identity. But they managed to turn him around and make him work for the Rhodesian army. And what they did is they would take him on tour around the country, and they would summon all the villagers from various villages around. Quite often it was 1,000 at a time. And we went on one of these stories up near Mount Darwin. Well over 1,000 villagers were there. And this guy, this clown, would give them a lecture, harangue them about how dangerous and nasty and evil Mugabe was and how much better life would be under the white Rhodesians, which, as we know, turned out to be right in the end. And then, as part of the act, he had a Kalashnikov in his hand and a rifle, and he would then go into the crowd and he would pull out six young boys, 12, 14 years old, as recruits to Mugabe's guerrilla army. He would pull them out and scream and shout at them, and he would give them wooden rifles and he would parade them. And then he would say, right, we're going off to shoot the white Rhodesians now. And then he would march off with them to a prearranged spot, whereupon they were promptly ambushed by a group of Rhodesian army soldiers, and there would be pandemonium, and the Rhodesians would fire in the air, and there was lots of fun, and the crowd were impressed. And we were filming all this, marvelous story. Then all of a sudden we realized that we were being fired at ourselves, what we call incoming. And we looked up, and sure enough, on the hills not so far away, we could see flashes of light from the guns and reflections of the guns in the sun. And sure enough, the guerrillas were up there. They'd been watching the whole show. And then, probably prompted by the, maybe panicked, so when suddenly they heard this gunfire, they started to fire at us. And the whole crowd disappears, screaming, panicking. And we lay flat on the floor as best we could, while the Rhodesian army chased the guerrillas away. So that was my one and only under fire experience in Rhodesia. We did another story up at Mount Darwin. I remember one of the very first stories. We heard that an old farmer near Mount Darwin had got his own mine clearance. And so we go belting up there. It's a long journey, 3 or 4 hours. And sure enough, yes, said the old farmer. He said, yes, I got a mine clearance. And he called up Major, and out came Major, this very even older black labourer with a huge shovel. And Major was ordered to go up the track, banging the ground with his shovel, with us and our camera and the old farmer a good 30 or 40 yards behind. And that's how the old farmer made sure his lane was clear. We later discovered that the old farmer did not survive the war, but the old black labourer did. So there was a justice there. We also went south on one occasion to what I think was probably the most macabre story of the war, and that was down at Triangle, which is a huge area of land, hundreds of thousands of acres, in the corner where South Africa, Rhodesia meets South Africa and Mozambique. And huge ranch land, and one of the biggest ranchers, the biggest rancher down there, he owned most of it, was a man called Boss Lilford. Now, he was known as Mr. Rhodesia, immensely wealthy, founded the Rhodesia Front Party that declared UDI, and it was he who put Smithy in charge of it. So he kind of virtually ran the place. The problem was that the Mugabe's guerrillas were rustling his cattle, coming in at night and taking cattle across into Mozambique so they could feed off them with their milk and meat. And Lufu was determined to stop this. So he employed some Belgian mercenaries to try and shoot these rustlers. They ended up raping most of the girls in the villages around, so they had to go. And then he had some French mercenaries. And they left because Lilford was paying them $200 for every guerrilla they shot, $200 US, and the Rhodesian government backed that up with another 200. So, you know, it was 400 a kill, which was a lot of money. But the French, and the way they did it, once you'd shot a guerrilla, or anyone out after curfew, 6 o'clock curfew, you just cut off his ear and brought it back to Lilford, and on presentation of an ear, you were paid your money. The French, though, thought they would double their salary by cutting off both ears until they were rumbled and Lilford got rid of them. So eventually, a man called Harry turned up. Harry came from Liverpool. He was a Brit and an ex-British army, but obviously had been chucked out of the army for reasons he wasn't willing to make public. He obviously such a villain that the Rhodesian army wouldn't accept him either. So he heard about Boss Lilford looking for a mercenary, and he was a good shot. And we interviewed him. He was quite happy to be interviewed. Quite astonishing, really, after what he was to tell me. He was out on the S&B Dam one night on patrol, and he suddenly heard a sound. It was after curfew time. So he waited for this person to come into view, and it was an old man, drunk as hell, carrying a pot of beer, a dirty old white nightshirt on, obviously been to a funeral or a wedding. And as he came along the path, 400 yards away, Harry lifted his rifle. He said, "I was just about to squeeze the trigger." I had him full sight, got him straight in the chest. I recognized the song. At least I thought I did, he said. Anyway, he's on there, $400, too much, too good to miss. Easy target. Lifted up again, and just about to get him, press the trigger, when he recognized the song. And it was, the old man was singing, "Old MacDonald Had a Farm." And Harry said to me, "How can I shoot an old blackie singing that song?" So he didn't let him go. But Harry's mistake was that he told Boss Lilford the next morning. And Lilford didn't want an old softy like Harry guarding his cattle, so he fired him. So that was they were the kind of stories we were covering. I mean, my job, isn't it? It was very hard, sometimes kind of impossible, to know the rights and wrongs, and or the good and the evil that was going on in Rhodesia. You know, it's so easy to cover a war when you know who the goodies and the baddies are. Vietnam, you know, they were the goodies and the baddies, and so many other wars I've been to, it's easy to distinguish whose side you think you should be on. But there was so much black propaganda and so much black, what we call black mischief. For example, if a village was known to be supporting the Rhodesians, then Mugabe's guerrillas would come in, kill a lot of them, burn the village down. Likewise, if they were known to be supporting the guerrillas, The Rhodesians would come in and do exactly the same thing. Sometimes, you know, there were more black Rhodesians in the Rhodesian army than there were whites. And so what they would do, they would dress up black soldiers in Mugabe's outfits, in his uniforms, and they would attack villages and kill and burn. So the villagers, or the word got around that Mugabe's men were evil, and you know, that was the kind of black mischief that went on. I remember also the Rhodesian intelligence services got up to astonishing tricks. For example, Joshua Nkomo's ZAPU guerrillas had to cross from Zambia across the Zambezi Valley, which is a wide stretch, open stretch. During the summer, these guys would die of thirst, sun exposure. In another season at night, it got very chilly there. So if they found clothes, they were delighted. And, of course, the Rhodesian military would deliberately leave clothes on the ground as if they'd fallen off a lorry or something, or been left behind by a farmer in a hurry. And these guerrillas would say, wonderful, here's a nice warm overcoat to put on, or a pair of trousers, or a pair of socks. And once they did, they would die, because these clothes were impregnated with a poison that attacked the skin and the nervous system, and they would die a horrible death. These are the kind of things. We would come across coaches. I remember one terrible crash, over 30 people died, just burnt alive in a coach that had been hit in an ambush. We didn't know whether it was Mugabe's people or the Rhodesians, but I do know that somebody, after the war ended, somebody who was working for the Ministry of Information, who would have had access to this kind of information, committed suicide, because obviously she couldn't bear the thought that she'd been supporting a regime that did that kind of thing. So it wasn't, to coin a phrase, black and white for us. We had to be very careful how we reported it. Another one of the early stories I remember was the protected village. It's something that the Americans did in Vietnam, that is to separate villages from the guerrillas, because, you know, the villagers provided food, shelter, information. Guerrillas can't operate unless they have that kind of support within the area. So to deny the guerrillas food, succor, information, they would move the villagers into what were called protected villages, just huge camps, 10, 15,000 people in the camps, surrounded by barbed wire and patrolled by the Rhodesian army, and they were supplied with food and everything they needed there. I mean, it wasn't a prison. They were simply not allowed to leave. They could go and work their fields during the day, but they were back inside by dusk. And, you know, they were called concentration camps during the Boer War, weren't they? British concentration camps. So that was what... and another story I remember we did, which had a rather... I suppose you'd call it a funny ending, if it wasn't so sad. A man called Peter Dodds was running the Rhodesian Family Planning Unit. And he would go out to villages with his team. Dangerous job, because a lot of these villages were, you know, known to be within the guerrilla areas. And through interpreters, he would tell them the importance of family planning, planned families, and contraception. And he would leave a supply of pills for the women and condoms for the men, all of which we filmed, and it was a nice story. And then we went back some months later to discover that the women had swallowed all 30-odd pills, month supply in one go, and the men had used their condoms to keep their tobacco moist. I say, very sad, very funny too.
Did you interview any of the leaders? You know, Ian Smith, for instance.
We frequently interviewed Smith, and I also interviewed Mugabe. It's one of the odd things about a reporter. You can be on both sides of the war at once. And whenever sometimes African leaders would have a meeting, sometimes in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, sometimes in Lusaka in Zambia, sometimes in Maputo in Mozambique, And we would cover these meetings, of course, and we would have access to the leaders. Josh McCormick, of course, a big, fat, bumbling man of no real importance, even though he was the leader of the Enda Bailey, was never really in the running to be president, though he was offered the independence, offered a kind of non-executive presidency post, which he declined. Mugabe, you know, we found very articulate, very reassuring, excuse me, very reassuring, an educated man, a former professor, who we thought would be ideal. You know, he seemed to be, if the war could be ended and Mugabe was elected, the future looked very bright for Rhodesia. Smithy, of course, was totally intransigent. I mean, he believed that he was being betrayed left, right and centre by people he thought were his allies, the South Africans and the Brits. He had a very low opinion of Mr. Wilson. You know, there were frequent meetings. Fearless was perhaps one of the most famous to try and resolve it politically. But the Rhodesians had enormous confidence, you know. They really did believe that they could... what was Smithy's famous phrase? You know, we will rule for 1,000 years, he said once. I think Hitler said that too once, didn't he? But they really did believe that they were untouchable. They had oil from South Africa. They were breaking sanctions was easy enough. They had flights, sanctioned busting flights up to all parts of Africa. So they were never short of anything. There was nothing you couldn't buy in Rhodesia at that time. What they couldn't buy from outside, they made themselves. Very ingenious people. And as long as the oil kept flowing, and as long as they had the support of the South Africans, then they could have lasted forever. And they could have kept that war going for a long time. But, you know, a few things happened. One, the South Africans were having big problems of their own. And they needed to, more international recognition, more international help. And so they started to apply pressure on Smithy. And of course, oil was the fulcrum of pressure. If the Rhodesians were denied oil, then they were finished. The other thing that was slowly cottoning on to families was, you know, was the war winnable? If it wasn't winnable, immediately, how long would it take to become winnable? Yeah, or, it was dawning on them, perhaps the war was unwinnable. So more and more families were saying, why should I send my sons to this war that we are going to lose? It was the same attitude the Americans had eventually in Vietnam. That's what stopped the war in Vietnam. Public opinion from mums and dads saying, why am I being asked to sacrifice my sons in a war that really has no purpose? And people were saying the same. They were sending their sons out of the country, either to families abroad or to universities abroad or whatever. They were just denying them, the military, the recruits. I'm not saying all of them, of course they didn't, but more and more were being to question the promises that Smithy and his government were constantly making to them that the one day the war would end. So there were two reasons. And eventually, of course, we know that the main reason was South Africa suddenly saying, no more oil. You must come to terms. You must... Smithy tried to come to terms in a kind of roundabout way with Muzorewa, Abel Muzorewa. It was a very quiet, nonsense little man who would never have left the pulpit and gone into politics. And Smithy thought he could win over black opinion and international opinion by forming his, what he called his bilateral, bipartisan, bi-race new state, which was called Rhodesia Zimbabwe. And Abel Muzorewa was going to be the president, and of course he was just the puppet. And every black, you know, from the poorest labourer upwards knew that that's all it was. So it was total farce. And eventually South Africa lost patience and said, you know, you just have to come to terms. And it was South Africa that did it. And as we know, in 1979, there was a peace. It was made in London in the Lancaster House Agreement, overseered by the British government, Lord Carrington. And by the end of 1979, the war had stopped. The assembly points took in thousands of guerrillas who were disarmed, again overseered by British troops. I remember on one occasion up in the Zambezi, a place called Manor Pools in the Zambezi Valley, where no white man had been in 5 or 6 years. There was an assembly point, and half a dozen British troops and a Land Rover were going up this track, which everyone thought was suicide because it had to be mined, to meet this force of guerrillas who had been fighting every white man, you know, for the past 5 years, 6 years. And we followed them. We followed this Land Rover, open Land Rover, and we just kept our camera running. You think it's a ghastly thing to admit to, but, you know, we were there to cover the news, and we were certain this thing would go up, be blown up. And we just kept running our camera behind them, waiting for the explosion. It didn't come. And when we got to the guerrillas, they laid down their arms. And British troops, in the usual way, the professional way, organized the surrender. And, with one British policeman who came out, symbolic British law once more apparent in Rhodesia. It all went off so peaceably. Not a bit of blood was spilled. It was really quite astonishing. Really quite astonishing. Prince Charles came out for the independence celebrations. They had this huge kind of rally in the Rufaro football stadium. They had all kinds of songs, and Mugabe gave his acceptance speech in which he pledged that he would uphold the law and constitution of Zimbabwe, which from then on he began to break until, of course, it hardly exists anymore today. One sad little story that came out of it, one of the great sanction-busting pilots, the man who was a great friend of Ian Smith's, called Jack Malik, he had been a Spitfire pilot in the Second World War along with Ian Smith. And during UDI, he became Smith's chief sanction-busting pilot, would take out the DC-6s up to the Congo, up to Kenya, all over the place, taking out meat, bringing back essentials. He renovated a Spitfire that was on a plinth outside Old Sarum Air Base. And over the years, he rebuilt it until it became an absolutely wonderful, wonderful aircraft. And we did a story about it, a story about him and his Spitfire, which was grand. Then a few months later, into independence, Jack obviously found it impossible, living with the prospect that he was now going to be ruled by a black government. Been fighting it all his life. And one day he came to the airport in his old Spitfire leather coat and his goggles and helmet, told the control tower that he was going to go up for a half an hour's flight, do some aerobatics. And he took the Spitfire up, did his aerobatics, and then disappeared into the clouds and then dived into the ground, almost hitting assembly point. There were still the assembly points in existence then, where there were still guerrillas. Now, whether he'd aimed it for that campaign, hoping to kill them, we don't know. But he crashed into the ground. Now, people said it was an accident. I'm convinced that Jack decided that he'd had enough. If he could take out a few guerrillas on his way out, he would do it. But he certainly wasn't going to leave his Spitfire behind for anyone else to have. I believe it was suicide,